Good morning, everybody. Boker Tov, Shabbat Shalom. Welcome back. And let's talk a little bit about the Torah portion for this week. It is called Barak. Oh, wait a second. Or maybe that's Balak. It sometimes is hard to tell. But that's part of the point. We're going to actually spend a few minutes this morning asking some questions that I think are always important, and that is there are some very specific lessons in the Torah, especially in this Torah portion, and I cannot help but think that there are some, let's just say, really interesting parallels as well. And maybe there's a theme here. If it's, you know, if I was going to give this one a title, I'd say, is it Balak or Barak? Bear in mind that the real central character of this week's Torah portion is actually Bilaam, the prophet of another god, but he does seem to have the ability to hear from, not necessarily always listen to, the creator of the universe. And that in itself is one of the things that has kind of amazed and confused people for a long time. Here is a here's a pagan who seems to actually have this gift of prophecy to hear the Most High. What is going on there? And what's going on with this king, too, who really has decided that, okay, the physical won't work. He's seen what happened to Og of Bashan and the king of Sihon. So he doesn't think that's going to work. He is scared of the number of this people and the reputation that they have. So he's looking for another approach. And he decides maybe the approach that might work is a pagan spiritual attack. So he goes to the basically the evangelical tele-preacher of his day and tries to hire him. And I guess to some extent that hadn't changed. You can still hire yourself a good televangelist and or at least a well-known televangelist, both then and now. What I want to do is begin things this way. We'll certainly talk a little bit about the specifics of the portion. I usually hearken back to the fact that it's on Erev Shabbat, and that will be posted here too as well in the podcast, is where I go through the specifics of the whole portion from beginning to end. This one runs from Numbers or Bamidbar chapter 22, actually the second verse in the chapter, all the way through about the first third of chapter 25, verse 9. And of course, as you know, it begins, the first unique word in here is ve, and Barak, ben Zippor, the son of Zippor, saw what Israel had done to all these Amorite folks, and it bugged him, it scared him, because there were so many of them. So that's when he decides he's going to try to take a different approach. Now, what I want to do is say, let's look back at the last couple of weeks on this one and see if there isn't kind of a continuing theme, because this is arguably the second of some of the most confusing, I like the term enigmatic, Torah portions in the whole Torah. Last time we talked about the hukhat, that means plural, hook, one hook, at multiple hukhat, that had to do with, ironically, redemption from death. You had the red heifer. You have in between there the story of Miriam and her death and the water that is associated with her life and that stops upon her death. And then, of course, the idea of what about this brazen serpent and the nakash that's hung up on the pole that people just look at. That, too, is a hook. It's an enigmatic, why does it work? What is the point of all of this? So we go from a number of things that literally have to do with life and death, and in particular cleansing from death last week, that people have found, well, for centuries, to be confusing, to this story that is in certain respects no less confusing. How is it we have this pagan priest or prophet? He manages somehow to hear from the Most High. What's going on there? Isn't that a little bit enigmatic as well? And then at the end of the portion, it kind of seems to change gear and suddenly tell us the story that a lot of us have heard, Phinehas or Pinchas. And what's going on with that? I'm going to suggest that there's a consistent theme that runs through all of this. And I've already laid out a couple of elements. This idea of redemption from death. Okay, we'll come back to that. The pagan attacks. First physical, well, that doesn't work. Let's try something different. So we have Balak the king coming and finding himself, his tele-evangelist of the day, Bilaam, going to hire this guy to go do what it is that he does. And then there are some other parallels. And that's kind of where I want to spend a minute. And by the way, usual caveats apply too. Remember, there's a pretty long lag unless you're here physically. So if there's questions, we're always able to take those, whether they're local or whether they're online. I'm happy to do that. Just remember the lag. Back to the blessings. Because what we're going to find in the portion, of course, is that there's no less than three times that Bilaam, once he finally gets a message, hey, there's money to be made here, and if you keep pushing and you're willing to literally risk death before the Most High, eventually he will let you do what you seem to be bound and determined to do anyway with certain real clear conditions. And it's the real clear conditions that make what the Creator wants to have happen anyway. And there are some parallels in this portion. Literally, the blessings parallel real specifically. Matter of fact, even some of the same words are used. The blessings that we saw first in the book of Genesis with Abraham. Actually, at the time where the story begins, it's not Abraham yet, it's Abram. And this is something that I think is key and that I like to emphasize anyway. And that is, if you understand where the story of Abram begins, he is in a pagan land. The Midrash, the claim is, wow, this guy has a whole lot of history in his family that's associated with idols. We see that in some other stories as well. There's some unsubstantiated, some extra biblical stories about how Abraham does this and that, dissing the leaders, like, the claim is at least he had this interaction with Nimrod, that he had some things to do with his father's idols. I don't build any doctrine on that because I don't know that you can prove that. It's what you'd call either oral tradition or hearsay, but it's not explicitly scriptural. But regardless, it does seem to be demonstrable in scripture that Abram was a fellow who had more than a passing understanding of pagan traditions, and he certainly grew up in a pagan land, and yet he hears from the Creator. Is that all that much different from this guy Bilaam, who's in a pagan land? He hears from the Creator too. Well, the main difference is the following. Abram listened. Not only did Abram listen, right? The Hebrew word there is shamar, hear and obey. He had faith. It was counted to him, as we're told over and over again, for righteousness. He was told, get up and get out of here. Leave this land of your fathers and all of these things, all that you've known. You go to this land that I will show you, and I will bless you. Abram actually does so. Later, he gets renamed as part of that process. He demonstrates through multiple acts his fealty, his trust, his faith in the Most High. And literally out of him comes a not just a nation, but many nations. And out of him comes salvation for the world in many ways. And all of those things that we see, the blessings that were to be showered upon Abraham, those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. Those words appear in this portion. All of those things and those parallels appear here as well. So that kind of brings me to the one of the key aspects of the Parsha, and this is the one that from time to time I think it's just amazing. If you go say to yourself, what are some places in Scripture where we see the sense of humor of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? And I got to admit, the talking ass is probably one of the funniest, literally, and the most poignant. In so many respects, I mentioned this last night. If you simply, when I use that word, and I use that word kind of pointedly, one, of course, you know that, at least people maybe once upon a time knew this. In English, the word ass is a female donkey. So if you accept the King James rendering of it, and actually you can go back and look at the Hebrew, this is a female donkey that is being discussed here that Bilaam is riding. But it seems that literally we have this cultural issue with the word ass, right? It's been associated with other things. And in particular, you'll hear terms like dumbass. So maybe the ass gets a bad rap. And in this particular case, the thing that's so amazing about the portion is I tend to suspect that part of the reason why the ass has been elevated, for good or for ill, in our cultural lexicon to where it has a lot to do with this story right out of the Bible. Although a lot of people don't probably like to admit that. And it's a great demonstration of the long-lasting impact of the Creator's sense of humor. So think of it. He has taken the major televangelist of his day, this guy Bilaam, who, remember, is told by Barak, the king, I've heard your reputation, man. You are some kind of major dude. I know that him who you bless is blessed, and him who you curse is cursed. Now, wait a minute. No, it's Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh that has that distinction. That was what was said to Abraham. Isn't it interesting that that now that Bilaam has been elevated to the status of a demigod or someone who can do what God does, he needs to be set back in his place. Maybe he has too high of an opinion of himself. Same thing goes for Balak and others. We're going to see that illustrated in this sense of humor as well. So we know the story, and without having to go through the whole thing again, it's Bilaam's ass that saves his ass, literally. Multiple times, he gets himself into trouble. He doesn't know it, of course, but there is a messenger, a malach of the Most High that has come, bearing a great big huge sword, fixing to whack on him, dispatch him with the sword, and it is his female donkey that saves him. More than once. He keeps whacking on her, and then eventually the Creator opens her mouth, and she says, basically, am I not your ass that you've ridden on all your life long to this day? Have I ever done anything like this to you before? What's your problem? No, he says. You mocked me. If I'd have had a sword, I'd have killed you. Well, at this point, Bilaam gets his eyes opened, and he sees the punchline of the cosmic joke, and sees the angel of Yahuwah standing in front of him with his sword drawn in his hand, and he's, why have you smitten your ass these three times? Behold, I have come before to you as an adversary. The word there in Hebrew literally is Satan, and your way is contrary to me. It is, in fact, your ass that has saved you these three times, turning aside. Otherwise, I'd have waxed you by now. I have sinned, says Bilaam. So, to his credit, on occasion, he does seem to kind of get it. He gets the joke here. There's a little bit more to this, I guess, and I think that's interesting. I did the check, because I thought there's a Hebrew terminology that's often used, but it's not explicitly biblical. Turns out, if those of you that have heard about, the sense of humor of the Almighty before, I've got several friends over the years that I've known that are rabbis. Usually they'll quote it, but it turns out that what they're quoting is not the Hebrew, but it's Yiddish. Okay, so this is a famous Yiddish phrase. Some of you have probably heard it. Mensch tracht und Gott lacht. Means a man plans and God laughs. And there is a real element of that. And most of the time when people mention that particular Yiddish phrase and point to it, it's this story, among several others, that will go to the fore. So we've got these elements, right? Where are we at so far? We got this element last week of redemption from death, cleansing from death, multiple enigmatic chukat that are associated with it. We've got this idea of a pagan king, Balak, or whatever name that might rhyme with that, who has a realization that the physical upfront attack won't work. Now, by the way, the reason why I said Balak or Barak earlier, think about this. The physical upfront attack won't work. You want to destroy a people that were once upon a time one nation under God? A people that once upon a time literally knew that it was God-given rights, that the function of government, the sole purpose of government, said the Declaration, was supposed to protect? That these rights come from God, not from any power on earth, and that all people had to do was to be obedient, walk humbly before their God? In other words, and by the way, they just happened to be the best, most well-armed nation in the history of planet Earth. Depending upon whose numbers you believe, probably 300 plus million guns, maybe more, in a nation of 300 plus million people. So arguably, then as now, the physical attack won't work. Well, let's do what? Well, let's plan a spiritual attack instead. So whether it's Balak or Barak, the spiritual attack, and by the way, it's not just this most recent pagan king that's been doing this. This attack on the people of Yah goes way back, way, way back even. And we could spend, hours just talking about the history of those attacks. But clearly, in so many areas, they're spiritual. And some of those parallels we're going to return to today as well. But there are blessings. There are blessings for a people who are obedient. And those blessings get reiterated. This is part of the major plan. This is part of how, even though, as he is making fun of this so-called mighty man of the Baals, Bilaam, the prophet, a legend in his own mind and in his own time, who is not quite as sharp as the ass that he's riding on, he sees it not as well as she does. The Creator has this grand plan. He is able to project and keep his plan on track, not only with a sense of humor, but a whole lot of irony too. And what we see coming out of this, of course, is that these blessings are repeated. And not only are the blessings repeated, but they are ensconced in genuine print for all history. When the portion ends this week, after we see Bilaam doing what it is that he was bound and determined to do for Balak, when all is said and done, it doesn't sound like he gets his money. And there's a bit of irony in that too. The king says to him, you blew it, man. And you were obedient to that God. That cost you. That cost you this wonderful reward here. Well, after all of that is done, we get a major shift. I sometimes refer to it, because of my Missouri upbringing, as a Tasmanian downshift. I'm not even sure what the origin of that is, although I do remember a cartoon when we were kids about a Tasmanian devil. And anyway, we always talk about a Tasmanian downshift as when something just seems to come kind of out of the blue. Where did that come from? And if you look at the end of the portion, as we turn into chapter 25, you got this long story that doesn't involve any of the children of Israel. Balak and Bilaam, and finally, they basically, it says at the end of chapter 24, Balaam rose up, he went to his own place, and Balak the king, he too, went on his own way. And at least for now, that seems to be the end of the story. And then what? Chapter 25, Israel abode in Shittim, and the people began to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab. Say what? They sacrificed to their gods, they ate, they bowed down to these foreign gods. What has that got to do with anything, and how did that happen? The truth is, it's laid right out here before us, but we have to kind of read ahead, connect some dots, and then it becomes clear what's going on. It looks like Bilaam thinks, not quite, remember there's still a sense of humor of the Almighty to deal with, he thinks he's had the last laugh. And it seems to boil down to something like this. Now I'm going to paraphrase what we're going to see in the Torah portion a few weeks out. But basically, you can't get these people directly, not with the frontal attack. You try to get this guy who thinks he's the prophet, de tutte prophets, to curse them. Those who you curse are cursed. Nope, that doesn't work either. Turns out Bilaam even realizes that when push comes to shove, I can do nothing except what it is that the Creator, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, tells me to do. And he actually got that part right, so he does that. But wait, maybe there's another way. Maybe we can come in through the back door. Maybe we can get them to kill themselves. Maybe we can get them to destroy their own blessings. And that is the real, not just punchline, but bottom line here. That's part of the bigger plan, and that's, I think, the essence of the major grand plan that the Creator is laying out for us as well. In other words, folks, we're told this. It's not like this is hidden. It's just that he has a number of ways of making the point. It's not enough to pay lip service to the Creator. It's not even enough to be at least on paper obedient. Bilaam was obedient on paper, right? This guy, he's kind of like the Clintonian version. All depends on what the meaning of the word obedient is. He was obedient as long as he felt like being obedient. That's the difference, again, between him and that fellow Abraham, who was obedient with his whole heart, who literally would follow Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh to the ends of the earth, and to the point of if he thinks that he's told to take his son, your only son whom you love, up and make a burnt offering of him. Well, okay, I know he isn't gonna sacrifice my son permanently. He knows darn well that the promises are gonna come through his son Isaac. So Abraham doesn't hesitate. I love that kind of faith. Well, Bilaam doesn't have that kind of faith. He's in it for the bucks. He's in it for number one. And everybody gets the specific message intended for them in this story. And the bigger picture message even includes the fact that Israel, who is blessed by the Creator, can still make a choice. That's the key I'm going to suggest applies to us too. Scattered Israel, scattered through every nation, tribe, people on earth, we still have the same choices that have existed literally since the beginning. Deuteronomy 30, one of my favorite verses. I've laid before you this day life and blessing, death and cursing, so choose life. Choose life, choose obedience, walk humbly before your El, and all kinds of good stuff will happen. But you can, in fact, choose curses too. That brings me back to kind of the central part theme-wise of this story and the ending part story-wise of the story. And that has to do with what I was already referring to as the Tasmanian downshift. Why is it that all of a sudden Israel starts to commit harlotry with the daughters of Moab and start bowing down to their gods? The people ate and bowed to their gods. And then it says, verse 3, now this is where we're going to spend a couple minutes here. Israel joined himself, this is singular, referring to Israel as if it was the single man, Jacob, renamed, joined himself unto Baal of Peor, and the anger of Yahuwah was kindled against Israel. Why? What's going on there? What is this Baal Peor thing that's being talked about? Oh, turns out it's not the first time we've seen that particular word, Peor, and also of previous time, first used in Scripture, is in this Torah portion. But whatever it is that's being talked about here, it cost a whole lot of people their lives. Remember, this ends with 24,000 people dying of a plague. It seems to have happened pretty rapidly, too, as well as some of the leaders of Israel that were made examples of. And then the really enigmatic part, enigmas upon enigmas in this one. A fellow named Pinchas comes forward and does what looks to our maybe the uneducated like murder. He commits murder in cold blood, and for that he is rewarded with the covenant of peace. Another one of the perhaps most confusing stories in Scripture. So how do we know what's going on here? Let's stop, take a look back, and again, I'm going to keep emphasizing that I will come right out and say it. I think this Baal of Peor thing is appropriate then. It's key to understanding the story, and it's key to understanding where America with a K is in the year 2016 and what's happening now and in the future. Maybe we can take some examples and look at them. Verse 28 of, let's see, what chapter is this? I think it's chapter 22. Nope, chapter 23. Balak, the king. This is the third of three. This time, getting ready one more time. Let me see if you can't bless him this time. The king takes Balaam up to the top, and the word here in Hebrew is not just top, it's Rosh, right? We know what the word Rosh means. It means head. To the head of Peor, whatever Peor is, and it's actually Ha Peor, head of the Peor, and looks down on the top of the desert. The historians and the people that have looked at this and connected all the dots say, okay, well, there is something that we know about called Baal worship, the Lord of Peor, Baal Peor. And this, the top, the head, the Rosh of Peor, is the home of, Baal Worship Central. So he literally is at the heart of whatever it is that's going on here that is called Baal Peor worship and similar. Oh, okay, so, well, we know that the Hebrew words usually have some amazing meaning. What does the word Peor mean? Warning here. I'll probably have to put a warning on the podcast. This is an R-rated presentation because we're going to talk about some adult things. And probably all I have to do, but I'll try to go a bit further, is to just mention what these words mean. Give you a couple of the references. Peor literally has a number of meanings, and there's a peor, and there's a basically par. The pay ein resh root, and then the place name, which is almost the same word, but with an extra vowel sound in it. As a verb, peor means to open wide. to gape. As a noun, the word means cleft or yawn or something that gapes. Are we beginning to see the picture? All right, let me just lay it out. One of the clear references here is to the female sex organ, which can open wide and which can be a cleft and which can yawn and which can gape. And that is precisely what the daughters of Moab did in order to entice the sons of Israel, the B'nai Israel, into committing whoring. Okay? And you can just imagine, hey, you like the looks of this? Wanna explore this gaping, yawning cleft here? Well, then you have to understand a little bit about the Lord of the opening, and that is literally what the word Baal Peor means. Lord Baal of the opening, the cleft. The thing that opens wide, if that is, you're willing to get down on your knees and worship the Lord of the opening. And do the things that need to be done here. We're talking, in other words, about whoring. In another different way. We're talking about another way of committing idolatry, and we're basically talking about this. Let's be a little teeny bit crude here. Okay, yes. Let me ask it this way, because one of the questions I come back to over and over again is, who do we serve? Serve Yod, Hey, Vav, Hey, and Him alone with your whole heart. Who is it that Bilaam served? What was it, Balak? Not really. Balak had some money, but he wasn't loyal to Balak per se. Balak was a paying client. Now, was the prophet Bilaam serving? Yeah, certainly not. At least not voluntarily, not with his whole heart. He would not shamar. He did not hear and obey. He heard, but he had to be dragged on his ass, literally, into obedience. And eventually, what we find out in Numbers chapter 31 is his rebellion cost him his life. So who did Bilaam serve? He served himself, or you could say he served money. He served mammon. Love of money, the root of all evil. We've heard a lot of this stuff. What was he doing? Okay, well, you could say it this way. He was whoring. How is it that he finally realizes, oh, okay, you know, here's the kicker. Here's how we get them to whore themselves out. Here's how you come in through the back door and you get Israel to commit sin. You get Israel to choose something different. In the case of Bilaam, it was money. It was recognition. It was, you know, pride. It was all the stuff that we see over and over and over again through human history that motivates some folks. You can look at previous presidents, ask yourself, what motivated Bill Clinton? Is it power, like what motivates his wife? Well, not so much. I'm just looking for a little tail, you know. That's basically where he was. Offer the man some sex, and basically you could have nuclear secrets. You name it. Is that not doing him justice? No, he was probably a bigger sellout than that. But again, none of that is unique. Money, sex, power. How to corrupt people throughout history. It turns out that it looks like it was the sex part that got to the men of Israel, ultimately, and caused them to say, all right, I'll get down on my knees and serve this different God, Lord of the opening, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, because that seems to be more important right now than the creator of the universe and obedience to him. Let me read a couple more verses on this idea of Peor. I think probably that gets it. I hope it's fairly clear. What is always interesting to me about Scripture is if you go back and look at the original language, if you look at the meaning of the words in the Hebrew, a lot of the nuance is lost in the English. Okay? Baal Peor, what the heck does that mean? Well, yeah, some god. All right. The entire essence of what the story is telling us here can be lost. Even in the King James, okay? And as you know, I'm not one of these people that says King James only. You know, it's not a bad translation, but the whole point is, it's a translation. You really want to understand what's going on? Understand it in the original language. Look at the meaning of the names and the places and the words and even the nuances of the way the words are used and the alliterations in the Hebrew and some of the puns and the sense of humor that's there. That in some cases doesn't translate. You miss a whole lot. So let's back up again. Take a couple more looks at this idea of this word peor, cleft, yawning, to open wide, to gape, and the elements that might have to do with whoring. This line is interesting. The different word that we see used later in Scripture comes from the book of Job. Now, the book of Job is actually older, a lot of folks will say. It's probably the oldest book in Scripture. But verse 16:10 in the book of Job, some of you have heard this because there was a big rock song from when I was growing up. They have gaped, that was the Moody Blues, if I'm remembering right. They have gaped upon me with their mouths, right? Smitten me reproachfully upon the cheek. They gather together against me. That word, they have gaped, okay, is peor. Kind of makes the point. And in that sentence there, the context too has to do with reproach. And, you know, you can even picture a person with their mouth gaping open, in shock and surprise. I think all of that kind of fits a little bit with, the nuance of the word and where we are today. We skip ahead briefly to where we're going to be in a couple weeks. Numbers 31:16 is the place where the dots are connected for us, and it tells us how is it that we know this fellow Bilaam, the prophet, really did have a hand in undermining Israel via the back door. Answer. Moshe tells us, verse 16, it says, behold, these people that are at this point fixing to get whacked, these people, I can't read my own writing, caused the sons of Israel, the children of Israel, through the counsel of Balaam, and by the way, he's talking about some of the women too, obviously, the people of Midian and Moab, these people caused the B'nai Israel, the sons of Israel, through the counsel of Bilaam, he's the guy who gave them the idea, to commit trespass against Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh in the matter of Peor, the yawning, gaping cleft, and the so-called Lord thereof. So we talked about a number of things. Let's kind of take another stop and summarize where we are. What I want to do is I want to draw some of the parallels next. So we know who Bilaam served. Wasn't Balak? He was just a paying client. Was it Baal Peor? Well, he may have had some allegiance there, but I doubt he had any more allegiance to Baal Peor per se than he did the creator of the universe. But he after this incident, there was a private message that was delivered to Bilaam via the sword that the angel held for him and his own ass. And of course, directly when he heard from the creator, you had better listen to me. And he got that message. Speak only and, specifically what it is that he was told to say. He didn't shamar, hear and obey voluntarily, but he eventually, well, partly got the message. But we know his whole heart wasn't in it, because he still thought he could game the system. He still thought more highly of himself and his cleverness. He can get away with it. I know how we can do this. The message that Yah delivered to the rest of us is nuanced. And of course, as I've said, it's recorded forever. And it demonstrates a much bigger plan. You know, there's the blessings of Abraham repeated through Bilaam. There is the message that is being repeated through the entire story of the Exodus and where these people are. But the message is only partly complete when the Torah ends, because the rest of the story has to go with these people going into the land that they've been promised and doing the things that they've already been warned about that they were going to do. And that is, as we've already seen in the case of Baal Peor, they're going to commit more whoring later. Northern kingdom, southern kingdom, whoring, whoring galore. Same old story. The patterns repeat. The cycle repeats. As Solomon said, ain't nothing new under the sun. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what shall be done. And we go through it all again. Turning from him back to sex, money, power, you name it, other gods. The model, the patriarch, the example, is Abraham, who chose Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, left what he knew, the land of his fathers, and walked in faith, in obedience to him, wherever it was he was told to go. Did the things he was told to do, even if they seemed a little bit like a hook, a little bit enigmatic. He didn't know exactly how it was that the Creator was going to take his son, your only son Isaac, and make of him the great nation, and all these things would come through him. But he knew darn well Isaac wasn't going to die, one way or the other, no matter what Abraham did. So he did what he was told. Men of Israel, a little while later on, they've shown that, you know, it's not necessarily this or that. Now, they whine about water and about food and about give us meat. We like the leeks back in Egypt. But when it comes to really getting themselves in trouble, it seems that it was sex that managed to do it. They were willing to trade Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh for that. So I want to ask some questions, and we want to do this briefly. I mentioned the Menschtracht und Gott lacht. Men plan, God laughs stuff. I'm looking at a nice summary of the story. It fits here from Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. This is a guy that I read fairly regularly, and I tend to like his stuff. There's probably three or four people that each of us have personal favorites that I read fairly frequently. But this is a great summary. He says, all of this, this idea of divine laughter, explains the curious episode of Bilaam's talking donkey. He won't use the word ass, I will. This is not a fanciful tale, he says, nor is it simply a miracle. It arose because of the way the people of Moab and Midian thought of Bilaam. And, of course, the way he probably thought about himself. Right? And he names some of the things that we've already talked about today. This is the pagan understanding of the so-called holy man, the shaman, the magus, the wonder worker, dare I say it, the Obamasiah. The person who is above the law. Think about it, folks. What do we have running for president today but Hitlery? And I use that term, you know it. A woman who has clearly demonstrated that her qualifications for president are unexcelled because she is above the law. She can commit murder in plain sight and get away with it. Those who she blesses, at least so far as the world is concerned, they're blessed. Those who she curses are cursed. A lot of them are dead. She can commit the open assassination, well, semi-open, of a sitting ambassador in Libya, commit treason in the process of covering it up and making sure that national security is not only compromised but utterly undermined. The only people who don't know the content of those emails are Americans and the press. I guarantee you every other two-bit dictator, tin-horn spyware creator in the world and hacker like Guccifer has the emails. Vladimir Putin has them. North Korea has them. China has them. Israel, the Mossad have them. Everybody's got them. NSA probably has them. They tap everything else, but they're not going to tell you either. There are people who are above the law. Those who they bless are blessed. As far as they're concerned, they got the same thing going on as Bilaam. They're the shaman, the wonder worker. They have access to supernatural powers beyond the mere peons. Well, here's where I go back to the rabbi from Britain. He says, the Torah's view is, of course, precisely the opposite of all of this. It is Elohim who blesses and curses, not human beings. Even if they think they're the Obamasiah or Bilaam or Balak, who can hire the best of the best to do it for him, or Hitlery or any number of other politicians that think they're above the law, like the James Comey, head of the FBI. You know, I'll just come right out and say it, folks. I don't have much respect for people who put their hand on a Bible before God and lie. And who then commit breaking of vows. Torah is real clear. Numbers chapter 30, verse 2. A man makes a vow, he's to keep it. Period. Somebody puts their hand on the Bible and lies, as far as I'm concerned, they're not worth a damn. Or worse, right? Cicero famously said, the real threat is the traitor who is within your gates. All right, all of this, in other words, what we're talking about are things that are just plain antithetical to Torah. People that are oath breakers. People that lie, knowing full well. Bilaam was better than that. Okay, at least when push came to shove, he said, all right, I can only do what it is that Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh tells me to do. For crying out loud, could you imagine anybody running for president saying that today in America? Think about that for a second. Even the best of the pitiful crowd won't come close to saying that today. Back to the Torah's view. Yeah, it's basically literally the opposite of almost everything that's going on today. It is Elohim who blesses and curses, not human beings. And even those, and this is the part I want to keep emphasizing, who are the subject of his blessings? Ancient Israel, Kol Israel, all of the 12 tribes and those joined to them, the mixed multitude, and modern Israel, even if they don't know who they are, scattered through every nation, tribe, and people. There are blessings that are there. All they have to do is look upon them and accept that they apply. But you can go out and you can commit whoring. You can turn your back on them. You can choose death. You can choose to put the God of the Bible away and serve the Baal of the opening if you prefer. Or mammon or any number of other gods. Got a million of them. Back to the summary here from Rabbi Sacks. The donkey, the ass, sees the angel barring the way. It turns aside into the field, but Bilaam hits it, forces it back onto the path number of times. Eventually, the donkey begins to speak. His mouth is opened by the Creator. Bilaam then finally looks up, and he sees what it is that the donkey, who is wiser than he, has been seeing all along. Why? Then do we ask this question. What was going on prior to this? Why is it that Elohim first told Bilaam not to go and then finally tells him he should go and then was, I would say not surprisingly, angry when he actually went? He says he thinks that Elohim could read his mind and knew that Bilaam really did want to, you know, he wanted to make the money, curse the Israelites. I'm not going to argue with that, but I think there's even a bigger explanation here. He knew Bilaam's character. He knew darn well that the man was, as we might see in other places in Scripture, not really obedient, but just feignedly, wasn't obeying him with his whole heart. He had been told up front, no ifs, ands, or buts about it first time, don't go. But no, he wasn't willing to take that answer. He's going to keep pushing. So, time after time, when his first attempts to curse the Israelites fail, and his second attempt fails, and his third attempt fails, what does Torah tell us? Bilaam finally succeeds in causing them harm by advising the Midianites to get their women to seduce the Israelite men and provoking his anger against them too. Ultimately, Bilaam was not obedient to the Creator. He darn well knew what the point was here, and he was rebellious to that, and he was certainly no friend of Kol Israel either. Back to the talking ass. She is another instance of divine laughter. Here is a man reputed to be the maestro of supernatural forces. People were told, this is the popular story, that he had the power to bless or curse whomever he chose. Elohim? Forget him. Well, guess what? Bilaam was wrong. The Creator of the universe was right. And as it says here, he had two messages. I'm going to suggest, already have, more than two messages. One message for the Moabites and the Midianites, people of Balak. Another message intended for Bilaam himself. And finally, through this whole story, an even broader message, and that's the one that we're talking about today, of redemption in spite of rebellion. Let's talk about where we are today. This is where we make the transition. What is greater Israel? Kol Israel, scattered Israel, wherever it may be, not just in the land. Of course, there's a physical place with that name, a nation state that has that name. But in a lot of respects, there are some major differences there. What is all of greater Israel to do doing now? Some of you will know that in, for example, Tel Aviv is widely considered to be the gay capital of the world. The Rainbow City, they had some big to-do all about LGBT stuff in Tel Aviv. What was that? Just a few weeks ago, I think. Not exactly what you would expect to see in Haaretz, right? The land. But it's what's happening. ultimately the message is the same. You see it in America, you see it in Hollywood, you see it in all around the world. Sex sells. But there are a number of aspects to all of that. I find the whole situation with Islam telling, and yeah, it's double-minded. You know what we're told in places like Yaakov, the double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. Interesting how it is that Islam on the one hand says, oh, homosexuality is very forbidden. We'll whack off your head for thinking about it. But what is it that the imams and major players of the men of Islam do? Answer, they rape little boys openly. They commit sex crimes and the sex trade, and they will kill people and enslave women and do all kinds of hideous stuff. Something really weird is going on there, in other words. And to a large extent, I can't help but think we're talking some of the same kinds of things here with this incredible sexual sin and hypocrisy. And, well, one hand doesn't seem to know what the other hand is doing. Let me throw out one other element of this, and then we'll talk about some other things in the world today. I've already mentioned this one, too. Whose blessing are we going to choose? Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my house, said Joshua, we will serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Whose blessing? If we are, in fact, going to make the same choice, and many, many, many already have, it's the big sale that's being made to America with a K today. It's the sex sells part. Think about some of the implications, right? You see the popular movies and culture. Am I out on a limb if I say, if you go look and you see what is considered sexy, you see the bondage and discipline kind of stuff, you see the fashions, you see the markings of bodies that are forbidden by Torah, you see all kinds of things, in other words, that have these death overtones and sadomasochistic overtones. You've probably heard the term snuff films. A lot of really, really unsavory stuff. Is it therefore not surprising that there's this whole element of choosing sex and death over life? To the extent that we even deny what the Creator says about the wonderful things that He has given us sexuality to as a blessing. Not only for procreation, but for all of the fun and the wonderful and the joyful and the indeed family bonding things that come out of it. Strongest bonds out there, short of the bond that ought to be between us and our Creator, has to do with sexuality, properly, in a covenant form, enjoyed. So here we are. I guess what I'm trying to say is I want to spend the next few minutes talking about some tough choices. Literally, these choices are between life and death and blessing and cursing. To that extent, I guess there's nothing new. Whose blessing are we looking for? Are we looking for the Creator of the universe's blessing? Are we willing to do what He says and accept that when He blesses us, we are in fact truly blessed? Or are we going to open and worship the Lord of the opening, Baal Peor? The prince of this world in all of his, manifold, disgusting, death-oriented glory. I'll say it more bluntly. For those that choose to whore themselves out to Baal Peor and the world and the almighty state, we got tons and tons of examples of that. What is it going to cost the John? That's one of the messages that Yahushua points out. Count the cost. What's it going to cost you? Are there strings attached? Cost Bilaam, for sure. It cost the 24,000 people plus who died by making the wrong choice. It literally has cost civilizations and tribes and people century after century, because the choices have remained the same. Let's talk a little bit about some of the, the uncomfortable elements that people just don't want to talk about. Now, I have a copy here, and I'm not going to pick exclusively on it, but I saw Donald Trump's speech at the end of the convention. And essentially, I'm gonna pick on the New York Times, because I thought this was particularly disgusting propaganda. In reviewing his speech, they said, Donald J. Trump accepted the Republican presidential nomination Thursday night with an unusually vehement appeal to Americans who feel, they feel that their country is spiraling out of control. And I read that and I thought, what? Come on, are you idiots blind? You don't think the country is spiraling? What kind of fools are writing this crap who feel that their country is spiraling out of control and yearn for a leader who will take aggressive, even extreme actions to protect them? And I'm thinking, are they talking really, really extreme? Like he might honor his oath before God? Whoa, is that what? Well, I don't think we're talking that extreme. Let's be real here. The point is the following. People are still turning in the wrong direction. I don't know the man's heart, and it may very well be that is part of the Creator's plan. He in fact will put in place, you can name from King Cyrus to Nebuchadnezzar, to Saul, all kinds of kings and others who have been put in place. Arguably, including a bunch of really bad folks too on the list. Hitler and Stalin and Mao Zedong. And yeah, Barry Sabarko, or whatever name he's using today. Something or other, in other words, is going on here. It's, however, it's the nature of looking at the speech and looking for another leader, looking for another king that still concerns me. And one of the things that Trump said, and I give him credit for this, this is the reason why I mentioned the speech here anyway, the New York Times says, Mr. Trump sounded like a wartime president, using the word threat 7 times, promising to defeat the barbarians of ISIS. He promised some things that he'd said before too. In other words, he was giving wartime analogies, allegories, and comments, and he even said this right up front. This is the line that really caught my eye. I will present the facts plainly and honestly. Well, great. It's about time. Quote, we cannot afford to be so politically correct anymore. Great. Political correctness is part of a huge lie. And it's an incredible lie. I guarantee you that there was probably a lot of political correctness involved in worshiping the Lord of the Opening. It was politically correct. What are we seeing when it came to the situation with Pinchas and Cosby in that incident? This was a man who was literally willing to flaunt it in front of all of Israel. We, however, today live in a land where that's the least of it. If something is incredibly, diametrically opposite to the Torah, like, let's say a man lying with a man as with a woman, it will be flaunted. It's not enough. You know, I got no problem with people who want to walk in rebellion and say, I'm going to go behind this closed door and I'm going to do something that you don't have any right to know about. Well, it's not my business. Now, if you ask me, I'll tell you what the scripture says. But wait a minute. If you're going to tell me I have to subsidize it, accept it, support it, and that you're going to ram it down my throats, I'm going to tell you go to hell. Or something even more blunt. That's not acceptable. Somehow or other, we've gotten to the point where it's not just political correctness anymore. It is things, and I've mentioned this week after week, that are absolutely, positively, diametrically opposed to Scripture. Calling, yes, evil good and good evil. That is being rammed down people's throats. So while I respect the idea that, we can't afford to be politically correct anymore, I'm going to say, come on, let's be real here. That ain't the half of it. Until we are willing to stand up and say the whoring has got to stop, and that there are things that the Creator of the universe says are abomination to him, we got to quit saying those are going to be mandated and rammed down your throats. It's not just political correctness, in other words. We passed political correctness a long time ago. What's it going to cost the John to commit the whoring? Are there problems here? What I'm going to keep coming back to is the fact that where we are today, we have some amazingly, because we have gone so far down this road of political correctness, some amazingly tough choices to make. And while I respect that Donald Trump has at least achieved a lot of notoriety by willing to stand up and say, okay, we're doing a lot of stupid stuff. That's got to stop. Great. I don't see, let's talk about the really tough choices. For example, he talks about the Second Amendment in his speech. I don't hear him saying, you know what? We got to understand what the hell the word shall not means. We have 30,000 so-called laws in this nation that aren't law at all. Just having to do with infringing something that the supreme law of the land says shall not be infringed, period. And we're not willing to come out and say that, okay? Are we willing to say, we should vet people better who come in here and want to undermine the very foundations of the American republics? In other words, they don't believe that certain truths are self-evident, that there is a God of the Bible, and that God-given rights come from him, and that no government on earth has any power, even if they believe in Sharia law, to say no, off with your heads, we'll disarm you first, and then we'll whack you with the sword. There's a major disconnect here. No, it's not just about political correctness, in other words. It's about facing up to the fact, I'll say it, this nation has embraced Baal Peor. Not just the Lord of the Opening, but the Lord of the Almighty State. You name it, any pagan god, it's great. Think about it. Sharia? Fine. Islam in the schools? Fine. God of the Bible in the schools? Achtung! Now you have gone too far! Zat ist verboten! There hadn't been prayer in the schools or the acknowledgement of anything biblical, although it's getting worse and worse, literally since early 1960s. I can remember when the teacher got up and said, we can't pray in the morning anymore. When I was a young child, they used to actually start the day with prayer to God and with some cases the Pledge of Allegiance, all kinds of things that are, no, not even just Leave It to Beaver anymore. The only thing that is truly verboten, in other words, that is absolutely positively forbidden, is the Creator of the universe and anything that comes from him, including his instruction for us. Everything else is just great. Baal Peor. Let's address that concept head on for a second, because I'm going to suggest to you that there is a whole lot going on that is a lot more blunt than what people are being told. For example, we'll start with this one. This just came out overnight. I think everybody's heard about this. Give me some ones on the screen. I'll ask locally. Everybody hear about Munich yesterday? Y'all? Yeah, have you guys heard about Munich? Okay. Okay. Well, in case you haven't, there was a McDonald's, a shopping mall, and an 18-year-old, at least that's the claim now, an Iranian teenager who was born in Germany but obviously didn't quite adopt the culture, managed to get a hold of a gun. Imagine that, in the land of Gun Control Central, and kill at least 9 people. And then allegedly, like they always do, turning the gun on himself. Now, here's the thing. Originally, the story said probably multiple shooters. Say it with me, right? Now, it's a lone wolf terrorist. Lone wolf. Third act of violence against civilians in Western Europe, the second in southern disarmed Germany in just 8 days. He seemed to choose to pick out teenagers and younger folks. He killed 7 of them were teenagers. This line got my attention. Bavarian state premier Horst Seehofer said the killings in Munich and the earlier Axe attacks should not be allowed to undermine democratic freedoms. Huh? Ha! Ha! Too late for that. They don't have many of them left. And they've ruled out Islamic militants as any possible link. No, this has nothing to do with Islamic terror. Although, there were a number of reports that as this fellow was nailing people with the completely verboten in Germany gun, that how could a teenager possibly get it without help, he was shouting, Allahu Akbar. Why do I mention this? Because it stinks. The whole story, like every other one of them, just stinks. And it turns out that the fella had been treated for various kinds of mental illness, but the one thing we're not going to hear about, he'd spent time in psychiatric care, but not a word. about whether there were SSRI mass murder drugs involved. Asked if he had deliberately targeted young people, the police chief refused to comment. Asked how it was that an 18-year-old managed to get a firearm in a gun control system described by the U.S. Library of Congress as among the most stringent in Europe, they said, we don't have any idea how that could have happened. Only thing we know for sure is, yep, no links to Islamic terrorism per se, and he was a lone gunman. And then if that's not enough, overnight we have, this is the headline, I'll just read the headline. The religion of peace strikes again, this time Kabul. 61 dead, 207 injured in another suicide attack, already claimed responsibility by ISIS, the religion of peace. Earlier this week, we had Turkey. Okay, what's going on in Turkey? Answer, whatever it is, we're not being told the truth. It certainly seems to stink to high heaven like a false flag. The story, of course, one of the stories that some people are concerned about is that the Incirlik air base in Turkey was literally cut off from power. Of course, there are lots of Turkish officers. There are 50 B-61 nuclear warheads that are stored there. And the power was shut off for the better part of a week. I understand that it was just restored to the base overnight. And it certainly looks like the coup was a false flag. A number of indications on that, including how quickly it was put down and the stories that there may have, in fact, been advance warning. But probably the most damning thing to my mind was the fact that there were two so-called enemy Turkish fighter planes that actually had Erdogan, I know people prefer that, I could care less how he wants to pronounce his name personally, in their sights, had radar lock on the plane. Okay, if these Turkish insurrectionists really wanted the guy dead, they had every opportunity to knock him out of the sky. Why didn't they? Something stinks. Instead, they let him land back at home and submitted themselves to, at least if they were real insurrectionists, what would amount to certain death once they get on the ground. The whole thing stinks. The coup failed, and of course it's no coincidence that their Islamic jihadist in chief seems to have some real tight connections to the U.S. Islamic jihadist in chief. This story came out later in the week, but it actually happened a while ago from Fox. I got the link on it yesterday. Russian warplanes reportedly bombed a secret military base in Syria used by elite American and British forces last month. Part of the Russian airstrike on the CIA-linked site was a campaign by Russia to pressure the White House. In other words, stuff that people aren't being told. There's a lot going on behind the scenes. This predates the supposed failed coup. And, of course, with respect to Saudi Arabia, earlier this week we had the redacted pages from the 911 report that said, yeah, there's a lot more Saudi involvement here than we needed to let on because we wanted to try to convince you to give up your God-given rights in exchange for a little temporary security and put the Patriot Act in place and let us do everything else we want and make sure that the good Muslim terrorists can fight all the other Muslim terrorists. And, of course, when the pages were released, they were still redacted, so the important information is still being hidden. I mention all of that as kind of a prelude to this. And I spent some time on this last night, but I'm gonna go over this again because I think if you really want to understand Baal Peor and the paganism that has, I would say it's a cancer that seems to have probably done a lot more damage than most Americans even would remotely want to begin to admit. Take a look here. Obama, this is a piece from the Daily Mail, and I found it interesting just the way they phrased their headline. It says this in the big, great big print. Obama condemns discrimination against Muslim Americans as he celebrates Eid for the first time at the White House. Okay, Eid. Eid is a post-Ramadan feast of the Prophet Muhammad and the only God that is welcome in the White House. Obama broke, it says, from tradition. Is this a long-standing tradition? No, this is just a Muslim tradition of hosting the annual iftar dinner at the end of Ramadan, instead preferring to celebrate Eid this time. 100 Muslims came to the East Room to celebrate, blah, 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 and Obama said the following. The day should be a reminder that Muslims, quote, have always been a part of America, Is that true? I will suggest to you that it is one of those Clintonian lies. Muslims have been a part of America to the extent that, well, the first declared war that America ever entered, 1801, Thomas Jefferson, a great fan of religious freedom, by the way, but not when it came to people that wanted to kill others for their religious beliefs. In other words, his concept of religious freedom did not include those whose religion included sacrifice of people that weren't of the same religion. And there's a little bit of history there. We'll come back to that. What am I trying to say here? Muslims have always been a part of America. Well, on one hand, I got to say it, bullshit. But if you want to make the case, yeah, the first war that America ever fought, the line from the shores, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, comes from the wars of the Barbary Coast and Tripoli. Those were Muslim pirates that were attacking U.S. shipping, taking people captive, some cases killing them, in other cases carrying them into slavery. And several years prior to the declaration of that war, a fellow named John Adams, along with Thomas Jefferson, had met with the ambassador to Great Britain from Tripoli, who was a Muslim. I won't read the whole quote, but the fellow's name is Sidi Haji Abdul Rahman Ajda. And he told them something they didn't know about Islam, about how it was founded on the laws of their prophet written in the Quran. And basically, you all are sinners, and it is our right and duty to make war upon you all whenever you can be found, and to make slaves of all that we can take as prisoners. Because every Muslim or Muslim who would be slain in battle was sure to go straight to paradise. So Jefferson was shocked by this concept. It disturbed him quite deeply because of the tradition of religious tolerance to realize that these people are not serving the God of the Bible at all. Jew, Christian, of whatever various stripes, okay, we can at least agree on certain things, like thou shalt not kill, murder, thou shalt not steal, and so forth. But these folks are stealing and killing and taking into slavery. They're not serving the same God at all. Religious tolerance? Yeah, for real religions, not for Islam. He wrote about that. You'll hear the liar in chief talk about how, Thomas Jefferson and some of the other founders had a Quran. Yeah, I got no problem with people having a copy of Mein Kampf or the Communist Manifesto either. It's important to know your enemy. I've certainly looked at the Satanic Bible. I can tell you what the, thou do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. The fact that we know our enemy doesn't mean that we accept his premises. And the fact that Thomas Jefferson had a Quran, yeah, he was an intelligent man. He wanted to know what he was up against when he declared war on the Barbary pirates. A religion based on supremacism, whose holy book not only condones but mandates violence against unbelievers, basically, as he wrote, was unacceptable to him. I would say Islam has always been a part of America. No, it's a bald-faced, hideous lie. As a matter of fact, if you check, the oldest Islamic mosque in the United States, was it built in 1760, prior to the revolution? No. Was it built in the 1800s? No. It was built in 1929. Always a part of America, only to the extent that it's a little bit like the adversary himself. It's always been a part of the story, just not a part of the worship of the Creator. Yeah, that's true. Okay, I've pointed out before. If you assume that Obama's America has a K in it, it's always been a part of Obama's America. He said all kinds of things, and literally, people ought to be aware of this. For more than two centuries, Muslim Americans of all backgrounds, Arab and Asian, African and Latino, black and white, have helped build America. Bull. He said the following, we will prevail by working together. I have no doubt he was sincere on that score. They intend to prevail by working together. It's just that when he uses the word we folks, you ain't part of it. Where do we go next? I guess I want to make this point. Baal Peor. An interesting deception was involved there. We're going to spend some time over the next couple of weeks talking about a little bit more of how it is that Israel falls into this trap with Baal Peor and what happens. But ultimately, it's part of a pattern that continues to repeat. It's part of something that until we recognize it and acknowledge it, and this is the reason why it sounds like maybe I'm picking on Donald Trump's speech. Yeah, we got a problem with political correctness. Yeah, we got a problem with Islam. But until we're willing to admit that, you know what? What fellowship has light with darkness? Can two walk together unless they be in agreement? Can one serve God and mammon? Can you serve the creator of the universe and another so-called God or Allah or Baal that says, the hell with him and everything associated with him, and we will whack off your head unless you will pay fealty to this different God? You want the blessings of the Almighty State? Not if you worship that God. We'll take away your license to do business. Hell, you won't even be able to buy or sell pretty soon unless you take a mark and profess fealty. We don't care if you call it Allah or Hasatan or Lucifer or Beelzebub. Pick your choice. Just don't use that word that starts with Yahuwah or even anything that might sound like it. This one's interesting. Pokemon Go. I mentioned this before. A government surveillance PSYOP conspiracy, says a piece I've seen pieces on various hacker sites and tech sites and Gawker and places like that. The latest craze in America. Everybody's using it. Everybody is spying upon themselves and others, whether they know it or not. It is an app that has literally been created by a company called Niantic, but actually goes right straight to the CIA. And if you can't get people to rat themselves out with their cell phones, okay, remember, NSA knows all, see all. Big Brother is watching you. Every phone, text, email that you send, everything you do electronically, even things you don't think, are being monitored. The specs in the cell phones for years have required that they can be remotely activated and used as listening devices. But that's not enough. What Pokemon Go is a really clever, and it turns out it's pagan to the core. The little sprites and demons and weedles and zombies and all this other kind of stuff are right smack out of paganism. And everybody goes around and they go places and they video and they photograph things as part of this so-called game. And it just turns out that a lot of the places that people are being sent are places where just maybe somebody, like the Balak of the current kingdom, wants information on. And the phone does geolocation and mapping and actually takes photographs. Isn't that clever? Not only do you get people to rat out themselves, you get them to go to places where the people that are there know better and don't want to be ratted out. It's a private property, but if somebody trespasses on it and takes a picture, got the information anyway. Aren't we clever? Vladimir Putin is set to ban Pokemon Go from Russia. Militaries in places like Malaysia and a list of countries as long as your arm were saying, we got soldiers running around bases and photographing sensitive military installations as part of this stupid game. Geospatial Intelligence Agency and the CIA are behind it, yada, yada. Putin says he thinks that he wants to ban it from Russia after an internal Kremlin investigation revealed the direct links to the CIA and the wider intelligence community and how widely the information is being gathered on a colossal scale. So what's funny about this is just one more example of things that people aren't being told about how the God of this world is using every trick in the book, not just sex, but a whole lot of other stuff too, in order to enslave those who have, whether they know it or not, signed up to serve those gods. I want to talk just for a minute too about the false dichotomy, the battles that aren't being discussed. And I'm working up to a story here from a guy that does the automobile beat. Because everybody's heard, I'm sure, over the last few weeks about the thin blue line, the battle, right? Trump talked about law and order, going to restore law and order. Obama basically, whether people like to admit it or not, has been out encouraging Black Lives Matter to kill cops. I would tell people, I don't care what color people are, all lives matter. Uh-oh, that makes you a racist to admit something like that, right? The Bible says, thou shalt not murder. The word murder is important to understand. And certainly the word thou shalt not is important to understand too. And you know what? I'm going to suggest that that applies whether you're black or white or whether you got a blue uniform on. So for those that are working for NSA or TSA or various three-letter agencies or state or local police that took an oath before God to uphold a document that they've never bothered to read, and a supreme law that says things like thou shalt not steal and thou shalt not murder. And in fact, if you're not doing that, you got to deal with your creator. Be aware of that. So my problem is with oath breakers. My problem is with murderers. My problem is with thieves. And I don't care if somebody's got a blue uniform on or not. If you took an oath before God to support a constitution that says no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation and describing particularly the person or things to be searched and seized, and you break down a door in the middle of the night, we don't need no stinking warrant, or you search somebody's car or grope somebody's wife, you are breaking your oath before God, and it's not me you have to worry about, it's him. Do I have a problem with that? You're damn right I do. Do I care whether you got a blue uniform on or not? No, I don't. A thief is a thief. A murderer is a murderer. And somebody who breaks an oath is not a servant of the Most High. Deal with it. With that, I want to spend a minute or two looking at a good piece from John W. Whitehead. This guy writes for the Rutherford Institute, Lou Rockwell. Been around for a long time, done a lot of good work. He describes something here that is what America is today. I hadn't heard this term. It's called the carceral state. The carceral state. Basically, it's another word for prison state or police state. A carceral state, aka prison state or police state, in which there is no Fourth Amendment to protect you from the overreaches, abuses, searches, and probing eyes of government overlords. Well, it's not enough. They don't need no stinking warrant. Now they got people out there, I guess they should deputize them, right? Pokemon Go guy, going onto private property, using his geolocation cell phone to take pictures of things that even the NSA couldn't otherwise get pictures of. How clever are these servants of Hasatan. In a carceral state, writes Whitehead, there's no difference between the treatment meted out to a law-abiding citizen and a convicted felon. Both are equally suspect. All are treated as criminals without any of these special rights and privileges reserved for people like Hitler and the governing elite, those who are above the law. In the carceral state, there are only two kinds of people, the prisoners and the prison guards. Now, what I want to do quickly is read through a list of some things that may shock a few folks. Probably most of you here, not so much. But a lot of folks out in the generally dumb public, I'm sure, have never even been informed about some of the things that are going on. First, he says, understand what a carceral state is and why that term's used. Those in it have no rights whatsoever, except the things that their master, the almighty state, the God of this world, grants them. And the problem, as some have written, he describes an article from a journalist here who talks about the carceral state as a gray wasteland far beyond the promises and protections the government grants its other citizens. People in this state will kind of eventually over time, they begin to have some psychological problems, a sickening feeling, desires to sleep, rampant hopelessness, shame, rage, disbelief, clinginess to the past, that which is familiar, and eventually they get resigned and they accept the new normal. All of this is part of the dying refrain of an America that is no longer America with a C. No longer must the government obey the law. We the people are no longer shielded by the rule of law. You can look at the Bill of Rights and ask, does any of it still apply? But here is the case that I remember talking about this. A lot of folks aren't aware of it. Utah versus Streiff, 5-3 ruling not long ago. The Supreme Court basically said, well, what they did, let me just be blunt, they stuck a wooden stake in the Fourth Amendment and twisted it. TSA basically has been gang raping it for years, but that wasn't enough. They essentially ended the entire concept of probable cause. Well, no, that's been dead for a while. Probable cause was replaced with reasonable suspicion. Now, it sounds like just a, well, aren't those the same words? No. Probable cause supported by oath or affirmation. You notice you don't even hear that anymore. You had to have people that were willing to testify at risk of, what was it the Torah said? If you testify falsely against somebody and say they did something and you're found to be a liar, oh yeah, the penalty that you sought to inflict on them is supposed to be done to you. You want to throw somebody in jail for theft? If the Torah actually still applied, why, you would go there instead for bearing false witness against your neighbor. Well, we're long past that. But at least we once upon a time had a warrant based on probable cause. No, well, that was replaced with reasonable suspicion. We have a reason to suspect. Well, what's our reason to suspect? Well, we don't like your looks. Maybe it's just because you're a peon and you don't have a blue uniform. Reasonable suspicion, folks, is pretty much nothing. But the ruling now says, no, we don't even need that. The court opened the door for police to stop, arrest, and search people without reasonable suspicion, much less probable cause, giving police nationwide a green light to embark on a fishing expedition and rendering Americans completely vulnerable to the whims of any cop on the beat. Even Justice Sonia Sotomayor, not a woman that I have a lot of respect for, managed to get this one right in a blistering dissent. She wrote, quote, now this is a leftist who, for the most part, doesn't care much for the even-numbered amendments of the Supreme Law of the Land. But she did get this right. Like I said, this court, she wrote, has allowed an officer to stop you for whatever reason he wants, as long as he can point to a pretextual justification after the fact. Okay, the officer, she continued, doesn't even need to know which law you might have broken. So long as he can later point to any possible infraction, even one that's minor, unrelated, or ambiguous. In other words, folks, we don't even need a pretext anymore to do anything we darn well want. Now, do I have a problem with people killing anybody? Yes. Do I have a problem with people killing police? You're darn right I do. Do I have a problem with police, based on any pretext, violating the life, liberty, or property of a formerly free person? You're darn right I do. Sotomayor goes on, paragraph after paragraph, basically saying, you can be searched, and that involves more than just a pat-down. As onlookers pass by, the so-called officer, the criminal happening to wear a blue uniform. Why do I say that? Because these people put their hand on a Bible and swore an oath to preserve and protect and defend a constitution that I guarantee you, if they had ever read, they wouldn't be doing this crap. Searching someone without probable cause or a warrant, specifying explicitly. Come on! You got a blue uniform on? Can you read? Used to be people would say ignorance of the law is no excuse. Here's a person claiming to be a law enforcement officer, ignorant of the supreme law of the land. Do I have respect for that kind of an idiot? No, I don't. This is more than just a pat down. The officer, quote, can feel with his fingers every portion of your body, including your arms, armpits, waistline, back, groin, pelvis, testicles, the entire surface of your legs, top to toe. If you still can't read it, Sotomayor continues, saying this case allows the police to stop you on the street, demand your identification, check it for warrants, even if you're doing nothing wrong, and basically the officer's incentive to violate the Constitution thus increases. But hey, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Here are other things that the court, he gives Supreme Court citations for every one of these. First one, blood drawing and breath tests. They can stop you and take your blood, demand your breath. This is a violation of the Fourth Amendment by a case called Birchfield versus North Dakota. Ignorance of the law, right, is no excuse unless you work for the government. If police officers, according to Hine versus North Carolina, violate the law, they can be granted immunity if they claim they were ignorant of the law, that they are supposed to be a law enforcement officer to support. High-speed car chases, officers can use legal force, lethal force, and legal force without fear of lawsuits, no-knock raids, Well, that's perfectly okay because the occupants might destroy evidence of a crime. And if we don't need any evidence, then we can claim it was destroyed. Isn't that convenient? We didn't find any evidence because they destroyed it before we got there. We didn't need a warrant anyway. Legal ownership of a firearm also now constitutes sufficient to justify a no-knock raid by police, according to an abomination in the court called Quinn v. Texas. Warrantless searches, hey, let's not kid ourselves, there's a whole list of them. Police can search anyone who's been arrested without a warrant. They can search their property after arrest. They can search their vehicle. They can search their home. If an arrest of somebody else is made on the premises, we don't need no probable cause. We don't need anything except reasonable concern. We can extract DNA at gunpoint, forcibly, whether or not you've been convicted of a crime. Now remember, if your name is Hillary Clinton, you can commit felonies, treason, and murder, and you don't even have to testify under oath before a federal agent. Are we beginning to smell the stench here? Oh, and once police forcibly and unconstitutionally take your DNA without no stinking warrant, it will be stored in the National FBI database, Maryland v. King. Strip searches. Any American can be strip searched no matter the offense. They're calling it, literally, the license to probe. It's being extended to roadside stops as police officers throughout the country perform roadside strip searches, including anal and vaginal probes, without any evidence of wrongdoing. Remember, forget probable cause. And, of course, we don't need no stinking warrant. Seizures, for all intents and purposes, the moment you've been stopped by a quote-unquote law enforcement officer, you've been seized. Here's one they call search warrants on a leash, right? You know this, drug-sniffing dogs. They refer to them, search warrants on a leash. And any decent, well-trained drug-sniffing dog, of course, can be trained to alert on the hidden command. So, who needs a judge? Public transit passengers, interrogation, police, DUI checkpoints, information-seeking checkpoints are now okay. Used to be DUI, nope, now just information-seeking. Why? Why are we stopping you? Because we can, because we feel like it. Police officers are free to board a bus, question passengers, and basically ask for consent to search. Warrantless arrests for minor criminal offenses, including now seatbelt violations. We'll strip search you because you didn't have your seatbelt on. Stop and identify. If someone refuses to answer the almighty tyrant in blue, what's your name? That is a crime. No longer Americans, even charged with no crime, have the right to remain silent when questioned, Achtung, what are you doing? By one of their superiors. Traffic stops. A vehicle can be stopped, U.S. v. Cortez, even if the driver has not committed any offense. Now, here's the funny part, right? If you're driving carefully, that, of course, is a justifiable reason to stop you because you're driving too carefully. Or if you're taking a scenic route, that is also a reason to stop you, search you, probably arrest you. Anonymous tips, that constitutes it. You name it. Here's where we are. Phones and email surveillance, databases for dissidents, threat assessments, terror watch lists. Remember, if you're on the terror or no-fly or any other watch list, if you've written something we don't like, no guns for you. Infringements? Ha-ha! We're just getting started. Militarized police, SWAT team raids, security checkpoints, lockdowns, roadside strip searches. Well, there was a time when any one of those things, writes Whitehead, would have been called a violation, in no uncertain terms, of the clear text of the Fourth Amendment and roused the public to outrage. But no more. The dumbed-down public doesn't even know. And the dumbed-down officers that are supposed to enforce the law that they've never bothered to read because, hey, well, do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. Does that sound familiar? I'm quoting the Satanic Bible. That is what, literally, if you are above the law, shall be the whole of the law. Are we beginning to see the picture here? Can anybody really look me in the eye and say the United States of America has long since not only dissed, deep-sixed, and raped the scriptures, the Bill of Rights, the supreme law of the land, you name it, gotten rid of the God of the Bible, but openly worships, well, you don't even have to call it Baal Peor, Hasatan, an adversary. The time has been reset back to before we had a Bill of Rights, is how this guy concludes the problem, his article. Now, what I want to do next is just a couple of comments from this fellow's name is Eric Peters. Again, he writes about the automotive beat. And he says the following, and I think he's nailed it here. I'm referring, as we talk about all of this today, to we just got to come right out and admit it, folks. Balak, Barak, there is a spiritual attack, the likes of which we have not seen at least since Numbers chapter 22, that's being perpetrated on people who no longer know or care about the God of the Bible. The physical, straightforward attack won't work. And these people, in fact, then as, well, not too long ago, literally were blessed. I think probably there was time when most Americans would admit this nation was blessed by its obedience. The promises of Abraham, the founders, and many, many others who put their lives on the line for truth, justice, and the American way, and for rights given by God, understood, are as a result of our obedience to the Creator of the universe. America was a nation blessed. Physical attack won't work. But people can choose to whore themselves out. Whether it's money, or power, or sex, the old techniques still work. The attack has been and remains spiritual. I went through that abomination in the White House, talking about how Islam's always been a part of America. Yeah, we love Allah. This is a guy who would not have anything to do with the National Day of Prayer, because it's not to Allah. But lies to the American people about the history. And literally, people are turning to another God and then wondering why it is that all of this bad stuff is coming down and they don't even have a clue how bad it's already gotten. That was part of the point with the Whitehead article. I for years have pointed out that the Bill of Rights literally does not apply anymore, shall not be infringed. Don't kid yourselves. If you can't pick up a gun and walk down any street in the formerly free United States, keeping and bearing arms shall not be infringed, is dead and buried. And don't kid yourself. Years ago, I had an argument with the fellow who was the head of the NRA and still is, because he didn't know what those words meant. Myself and another reporter were interviewing him. He turned and walked away when we dared to imply that the NRA, and by the way, the reason they were there is for a Brady Act thing in Denver. These are people that proclaim themselves to be constitutionalists, servants of the Bill of Rights, and cannot read the simple words and say, you know what? If you don't understand what the clear meaning of the Fourth Amendment is, you can't possibly explain to me why the TSA has no constitutional authority whatsoever to exist. Trump, in his speech, for all the wonderful things he said, talked about fixing the TSA. How do you fix the TSA? You get rid of it! Period. You can't fix something which is an abomination to the very law that it is raping in the process of existing. Same thing goes for the Federal Reserve, whether people like to admit it or not. We're headed down this path. I'll just come out and say it. Everybody knows this. Everybody that's listened to me at least knows it. The United States has gone too far. I do not believe at this point it is salvageable. I believe the remnant can be salvaged from it, those who come out of her. And that is what we need to do. And time draws short. Back to Eric Peters. Addressing the situation of law and order. He says, look, if you claim to be a law and order type or otherwise, or especially if you're a law and order type, you need to understand. Cops are not subject to the same law and order as the rest of us. And that is a problem. And it's a problem for all of us, for them as well as us, because it's created this arrogance, right? We're above the law. We don't need no stinking warrant. It encourages extra legal excesses. We see them on video every single day. What are the evil people doing? What are Black Lives Matter and the servants of Satan doing? They're saying this is an excuse to commit murder. No, it's not. It's an excuse for saying what we need to do is get back to real law, not to do things that are worse. It's like saying, well, because we've already gotten away with murder, we'll just kill you all. No. We're moving in the wrong direction. lawlessness. It abounds. And because lawlessness abounds, the love of many is growing cold. If we can't see that, we're blind. And yeah, a lot of us are blind. When cops fear and loathe the peons and we return the sentiment, the results are predictable. Escalation, retaliation, all these things become inevitable. And what we're trying to do here, he says, is not condone, but to fix. People, not just black people, but lots of people are angry with cause. How to dial it back. Understand, law enforcement is supposed to enforce the law. And if they don't know what the law is, if ignorance of the law is an excuse, if you're above the law or got a blue uniform on and you get to keep and bear arms when nobody else can, that's madness. Okay, he talks about a bunch of examples. Officers literally beating a man senseless who is in a submissive position after a car chase while other so-called officers stand by and watch and do not do anything, including arresting their brothers in blue for committing assault in broad daylight. It was a Kodak moment, a video moment, recorded for posterity. But because the thugs were wearing uniforms, well, we know the rest of the story. Here's where I'm headed. This is the part that I think we need to understand as we ask ourselves, why is what's going on today going on today? If an ordinary Joe or Jane has a permit to carry a gun, right? Now, if it was constitutional, shall not be infringed means you don't have to ask for permission from the God of the Almighty State to carry a gun. It's a God-given right. Let's understand that. But I guess the point is, if you ask for permission, well, as Paul said correctly in Romans 6:16, those whom you submit yourselves servants to obey, you are his slave, whether of obedience leading to righteousness or of sin leading to death. So if you ask for a permit, well, you have your reward. Big Brother says, oh, yes, my slave, you may carry a gun as long as I think it's okay. However, anybody who has such a permit is aware, because it's hammered into the slaves as part of the permitting process, that you will be held severely responsible, not only criminally, but civilly, in the event that you handle a firearm in a criminal or reckless or legally unjustified manner. If, for example, you brandish a firearm, that's considered a felony. You have a firearm and you show it to somebody on the street in public. Like if you lift up your shirt to show that you have a concealed weapon. It's a criminal offense. You will be arrested for it. Your permit from Big Brother to carry a gun will be rescinded at the very least. If you point your firearm without demonstrable, legal, no, real probable cause, see, you're held to a higher standard. They don't need no stinking warrant. You had better have legal cause. And if not, it is a criminal offense. You will go to jail. If you shoot somebody, you had better be able to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that your life was in imminent danger. No, not that you were protecting your property. No, not that you felt threatened and because you were wearing blue, you need to go home. That's different. In most states, you have a legal obligation to run away unless you have no means of escape. In other words, the ordinaries, those who are not privileged to wear blue, have a legal obligation in almost every state to retreat. And if you don't, you're charged with minimum felony manslaughter, probably murder, taken into custody, not placed on a paid vacation, and allowed to go home. In other words, you folks are not wearing blue. I ask the question that he does. They can claim, I feared for my safety, so I shot him. I broke into this guy's home. And this is actually the case that got me years and years ago upset. I remember the name of the fellow, Ishmael Mena, an immigrant in downtown Denver, sitting at home, bothering nobody, watching TV, 10 o'clock at night. His door breaks down. Smash, smash. A couple of criminals in blue come in. Mena is having a Coke. He has a Coke in his hand. A fellow named Officer Beanie blew Ishmael Mena into the next universe because he was armed with a Coke can. Oops. Guess what? We broke down the wrong door. Didn't have a warrant anyway. Killed an innocent man armed with a Coke can. Guess how many previous murders Officer Beanie had on his notches in his gun? Mena was number 5. He got another paid vacation. I remember just being infuriated. Wrong door, no warrant, innocent man, dead. And the officer who's already killed five continues to be on the public payroll. Is there a problem with this picture? Can you imagine what would happen to a mere peon who broke down the wrong door, shot somebody in their own living room carrying a Coke can because he feared for his safety? Well, you ought to fear for your safety if you break down somebody's door, for crying out loud. But this is the nature of the police state we're in. The point here, and the point that I think this guy is making really well, is no, you do not kill cops. And cops, you do not kill innocent people either. And you don't have a right to do things because you're above the law that the innocent people out there don't have every similar right. Well, what was it they were once told? Oh yeah, what a concept. Protect and serve. I remember when they used to put that on the side of cars. Matter of fact, I think it's still on the side of cars in Alamosa. Okay, maybe there's places in the Front Range, too, where it still says that. Question is, do they still mean it? All right. I think this guy's making the point here, Peters. You know, in addition to being criminally prosecuted, the peon who dares to think he has a right to keep and bear arms will not only be criminally prosecuted, but also, almost certainly, personally sued by the victim and his family. By the way, there was a case in Norway just this last... No, Finland. A Finnish man was in his own home. Three thugs. Now, in Finland, of course, there is complete gun control. So the thugs had guns. The homeowner did not. The homeowner managed to defend himself from three armed assailants in his home and send three of them to the hospital, for which he was taken to jail and is now serving a 10-year sentence for excessive self-defense. That'll teach him. How dare you defend yourself from armed intruders? I don't care if they're cops or not. This is where we are. The term that I've used and noted for years, there's a term of law. It's called color of law. In other words, when a cop breaks down your door without a warrant, he is not a law enforcement officer. He is acting, if we actually understood what the law of the land used to say, he's acting under color of law. In other words, he is outside his authority. Let's suppose you're on a dark street and a cop car comes up to a woman who's got a flat tire. And he says, may I help you? Yes, officer, I've had a flat tire. I need some help here. Well, let's see here. Why don't you just go around behind the back of the car here, lift up your skirt, and I'll take care of myself, and then maybe I'll help you fix your tire. Well, that would be rape, officer. No, I'm sorry. I just feel like it. You're a peon. I'm going to do a strip search, and I might just put something where it don't belong. That officer is acting as a criminal, right? Could we not agree that that's the case? You'd think it would be obvious. The crime is called rape. But hey, if we can excuse murder and theft and all kinds of other violations that literally amount to rape too, at least if you do them, right? If you grope some woman's breast on the street, that would be called sexual assault, pretty much the same as rape in terms of criminal offenses. Why can't we just say, look, we've gotten rid of the requirement that the cop needs to worry about murdering somebody in their home. Why can't they rape too? And in fact, we already know this. They can and they do. Why? Well, because if the woman talks, bad things might happen. Don't think for a second it hasn't happened and isn't happening all over the place. I'm suggesting, folks, that when you start worshiping Baal Peor and the protection of the Almighty disappears, things get really, really ugly. And we're there. Here's how Eric Peters summarizes it. Ask yourself, who is supposed to be trained, right? The mere peon has to have training in order to be entrusted to exercise what was once called his God-given right to protect himself. No one is above the law unless you have a blue uniform, because law enforcers are above the law. Rather than being held to a higher standard, conduct that would be considered criminal if a peon did it, they are subject to a lower standard, should not be tolerated. Those who actively encourage and seek a career in law enforcement shouldn't be the bully who is looking for trouble and now given a legal excuse to get away with it. They ought to be held to a higher standard. I don't have a problem with any of this. The point is, of course, and this is where I keep getting angry about it, people put their hand on a Bible, they take an oath. Shouldn't we expect what the God of the universe says? we have every right to expect that they honor their vows. But we're not there. All right, we could talk about a number of other things, and I'm not going to go through some of the financial issues, just other than to say the financial system is breaking down at an unimaginable pace. With all the convention news this week, the real economic news pretty well got overlooked. For example, yesterday, John Deere announced they're going to lay off another 11% of their entire worldwide workforce. Caterpillar has suffered quarter after quarter of decline. These are the bellwether companies that manufacture heavy equipment, construction equipment, farm equipment. And when things that people need to construct and to farm aren't being purchased, there's a message there somewhere. Negative interest rates literally have destroyed the entire world financial basis. It has gone far deeper, the cancer, than most people are aware. And yeah, as bad as TSA is, folks, the Fed has literally, and the worldwide bankster glut, fiat money, has destroyed the entire world's economic system, to the likes of which we've never seen in human history before. It is going to be powerful ugly. So for all of those reasons, I guess I'm going to suggest, just as we see at the end of the story here. No, I'm not encouraging people to act like Pinchas, but I am encouraging people to be aware of what went on with Baal Peor and ask yourself the question, can you see any parallels between Balak and Barak? Can we not understand that there is a real, bright line, undeniable difference between the worship of Baal Peor and the God of the Bible, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh? And can we not understand that that same exact difference applies to the worship of Allah or Quetzalcoatl or any of the other pagan gods throughout history who demanded human sacrifice and basically said, you don't have rights? Forget thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, thou shalt not commit adultery. Do as thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. We're there. Let's close then with the Haftorah portion for this week, because it's a nice, easy summary. It does reference this week's story. I'm looking at Micah. Starts in Micah 5, verse 6, runs through the first part of chapter 6 of the prophet Micah. And it refers to some of the history, and we know the history. Remnant of Yaakov shall be among the nations, it says, in the midst of many peoples. There we are. We're there. Hear now, chapter 6 begins a few verses later. Hear now what Yahuwah says. Arise, plead your case before the mountains. Let the hills hear your voice. Hear, O you mountains, Yahuwah's complaint, and you strong foundations of the earth. For Yahuwah has a complaint against his people, and he will contend with Israel. O my people, he asks, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? Testify against me. I brought you up out of the land of Mitzrayim, Egypt, redeemed you from the house of bondage. I set you before Moshe, Aaron, Miriam. Oh, my people, he says, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, counseled, and what Bilaam, son of Beor, answered him. You need to know the righteousness of Yahuwah. Is it going to take all of these things, right? All these sacrifices, rivers of oil, shall I get my firstborn? Yeah. Verse 8 gives us the, let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Now, Solomon puts it one way. Prophet Micah puts it similarly, right? Fear God and keep his commandments is what Shlomo says at the end of Ecclesiastes. How about this one from Micah? He has shown you, O man, what is good. And what does Yahuwah require of you? But to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your Elohim. He asks some questions, says, Yahuwah's voice cries to the city, wisdom shall see your name. Hear the rod, who has appointed it. Are there yet treasures of wickedness in the house of the wicked? I will say, yeah, you're darn right there are. And the short measure, that's an abomination. Shall I count pure those with the wicked scales and with the bag full of deceitful weights? I'm going to paraphrase that. Are we participating in a system that we know darn well is corrupt to the core? How do you come out of that? I'll admit, it's not easy. But we better start making the effort anyway, because this other system is fixing to be destroyed before our very eyes. That those that haven't come out of it are going to find that the fallout can get them. Shall I count pure those with wicked scales, with a bag full of deceitful weights? For her rich men are full of violence. Her inhabitants have spoken lies. Their tongue is deceitful in their mouth. Therefore, I'll make you sick by striking you desolate because of your sins. Eat and be not satisfied. Hunger will be in your midst. Some will carry away, but it won't save them. And what you do rescue, I will give over to the sword. You'll reap. You'll sow, but not reap. Tread the olives, but not anoint yourselves with oil. Make sweet wine, but not drink wine. For the statutes of Omri are kept, and the work of Ahab's house are done. You walk in their counsels, that I might make you a desolation, and your inhabitants a hissing. Therefore you shall bear the reproach of my people. It's a fairly negative end of the chapter. And I actually read beyond verse 8. Isn't it neat? Verse 8 is where the sages say, you ought to quit reading there. I've shown you, O man, what is good. What does Yahuwah require of you? Do justly, love mercy, walk humbly before your God. Let's not talk about that negative stuff. Well, I will suggest we better deal with the negative stuff, because here we are seeing what it is that is fixing to be reaped. So same message as always. It's just that ultimately the timing is what is really fascinating. It is now in our faces. We're seeing the wickedness of a so-called religion. The religion of peace. What is a religion of peace? Well, it's the same thing as a religion that says thou shalt not murder and thou shalt not steal, where stealing and murdering are made sacraments. We live in a land where that's the case. So love mercy. Walk humbly before our Creator. And for crying out loud, let's try to come out of her while we still can. Okay, let me ask this. Any questions, comments? Either locally or online, we'll deal with those. Did I see any? Did any scroll by that I missed? Sometimes there are, and I wasn't paying as much attention today anyway. Okay. Yeah, don't see it. Don't see any questions. So give it another few seconds, and if not, then we will close as we always do with prayer. Yahuwah Eloheinu, Yahuwah Echad, Abba, we thank you, we praise you, for you alone are set apart. Help us, Abba, to see and to know when it is that we're being deceived and led aside to other gods by the Baraks and Balaks and the Bilaams and Hitleries and others of this world, by whatever name and by whatever associations. You got a whole lot of people, Father, that are serving other gods. A lot of good people who believe they're serving you, who have been led astray to the Lord of the cleft, sex, money, power, whatever the case may be. Abba, we know time draws short. We know that the deception that is prophesied in the days that we seem to be heading into rapidly is the greatest ever. Literally, even those who would be among the elect could be deceived were it to go on long enough. So we pray, Father, that we would be counted worthy to escape these things that are coming upon the earth, that we would be doing the things that are pleasing in your sight, that we would try to do justice and love mercy and walk humbly with you. Guide us. Let your Torah be a lamp to our feet, we pray, that we veer neither to the right nor to the left. Help us to be witnesses for those that are seeking your face in these times. Help us by our fruit to show those who would follow you the way that all of us should go. We know there's a harvest coming. We know that there are not enough hands to do the work that needs to be done. Bring us together, we pray. Bring us the hands. Help us to be found doing your work in the time ahead. And Father, above all, we pray that we would be counted good and faithful servants unto you. This we ask in your set apart name. Guide us, direct us, give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Help us to walk in a way that is pleasing to you.
for you are Yahuwah Rapha. You are Yahuwah Nisi, our banner. We thank you and praise you. Hallelujah. Amen.